Welcome to Short Hops. Derek Van Riper here, as always, with Bernie Pleskoff. And we finally have spring training games. Bernie, it's just great to have games to go to every day, in your case, or in my case, to at least watch on TV. Three, four, even five games some days now, every day through spring training.
Where are you picking up the games, DVR? What network?
MLB Network has them all.
Do they really?
Yeah, I don't have it. I think some of the local broadcasters take some games too. Like Fox Sports Wisconsin will pick up the Brewers over the weekend. So you're going to have a good number of games available. But I know like around the clock almost, MLB Network is going to have a lot of spring training games on this year. So definitely check that out.
Well, that's good. Well, I have to tell you, I had quite a treat yesterday in the first spring training game of the year. I got to see my first ambidextrous pitcher, and it was amazing. I've never seen a guy pitch right-handed and left-handed to two different batters, but it happened. Patrick Venditti, Oakland A's, has a extra, I guess it's a thumb hole that he can convert his glove. So he could face a left-hander and a right-hander. It's just, it's wild, you know, and the guy's a pretty good pitcher.
He would be quite the weapon to have if he ends up sticking. He's currently in camp with the A's. Venditti's been drawing attention, kind of going back to his college days. There's even a rule based on his ability to switch hands. I think he has to choose a hand, and the pitcher has to, or the batter then decides which side of the plate to hit from, and there can't be any further adjustments from there. I mean, he's the reason for that rule to exist, but definitely the kind of thing that I didn't know if I'd ever see an ambidextrous pitcher, but it seems like he's pretty effective from both sides.
Yeah, he is. He's just an invitee. He's not even on the roster, so I don't know with the Oakland A's bullpen if he has a shot, but it was fascinating to see, and you know, we can't forget that here in spring training, as in the fall league, these guys are auditioning for every other club as well. And trades are made based upon what people see. So this is an intriguing, and as you said, there was a time in his career when they went back and forth. The hitter would change, the pitcher would change, the hitter would change, right, left. So they made this rule that he has to stick with one side or the other through that batter.
Yeah, definitely something that's worth seeing if you can catch a game in Arizona or on TV and he happens to pitch, because it's rare. I've never seen anything quite like it before. Let's go through some spring training news and notes here, Bernie. I think we're going to talk a lot about catchers as we move through our episode this week, try to rank some of the top options behind the plate for the upcoming season. I want to start with the news that came down over the weekend. Chris Sale is unlikely to be ready for the start of the season due to an avulsion fracture in his right foot. He suffered the injury while stepping off of his pickup truck. He could actually miss a few starts, and I had a chance to talk to Jeff Stotts about this during the SiriusXM show on Tuesday. There really aren't many cases like this, so it's hard to know exactly if the White Sox timetable will actually hold up. The right foot is the one that Sale hurt. It's his landing foot as a left-handed pitcher. How worried are you about this injury possibly impacting him even after he's healthy enough to start pitching again?
Well, you know, anytime you're not 100% healthy, and if it involves his landing foot, it's an issue for me, and I think he is going to miss a couple starts. And I don't think it's going to be pretty for fantasy owners, because now you're down to 30 to 31 starts instead of 33, and it could be even more. Now, that's going to impact some counting stats. You know, it's not pretty, but it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. There's a good chance we'll see him back in April, but I think the immediate follow-up question for many people becomes, what do you make of Carlos Rodon now? Does this significantly increase his chances of breaking camp with the club, or do you think his development path is sort of independent of whether or not Sale's available to begin the year or soon after?
Well, I may be wrong on this, but there is no way that I would break camp with Carlos Rodon as that starter. I would start him, and I don't want his clock moving, I'd probably throw Scott Carroll or Eric Johnson in that role if I had to. But Rodon's going to get the start this week. He's going to get Sale's spring training starts. But I don't think, if it were me, he would start the season and pitch in a regular season game. He's too valuable, and I want to protect that time. Those two or three starts aren't going to change the season for me. And I can get by with Scott Carroll or Chris Johnson and then go to my very good bullpen. All I need is five innings from those guys.
I think with Rodon, too, it's sort of like the Chris Bryant situation on the north side of Chicago. I could see him getting up before the end of April, but you want to wait a couple of weeks just to ensure that he doesn't accrue an entire year of big league service time. That sixth year, having that take place down the road in 2021, as opposed to losing him after the 2020 season to free agency, I think that makes a big difference when you're talking about his potential value to the organization. So I feel like it is independent. It is kind of a good news sort of thing for Rodon that he'll get to make the extra starts with the big club during spring training, because that means more time with Don Cooper and the other coaches with the White Sox. I think that can only help his development, but I don't think they're going to push Rodon up just to give him one or two extra starts in April when that would ultimately cost him, the organization, a year of service time later on. Now, we didn't talk about it last week because I think it happened either the day before we recorded, and I just didn't want to talk about it yet, or maybe it happened after we recorded. But regardless of the timing of events, Francisco Rodriguez, yet again a Milwaukee Brewer, always comes back to Milwaukee. I mean, with Rodon or with Rodriguez, it seems like they're just meant for each other, and it always takes longer than it should for him to end up back under contract. Assuming everything is fine health-wise, he moves through spring training. He'll begin the season as Milwaukee's closer, Jonathan Broxton falling into a setup role. I mean, K-Rod pitched really well at the beginning of last year, Bernie, but he had major issues with home runs. He allowed 14 home runs in 68 innings last year. This, to me, could be a disaster.
I knew this was a pill you didn't want to swallow. I know that you held your nose, opened your mouth, and said, okay, shove it down me because I know it's going to happen. Well, it happened. And I think, DVR, it's multiple years.
Yeah, it's 2 years with an option for a third.
There you go.
Why? Why would they do this? I know he's only 33, but he got up to the big leagues when he was 20. So the amount of mileage on the arm is very high. I didn't want Rodriguez. I didn't want Rafael Soriano. I was okay leaning on some of the younger arms. I was okay with the idea of Jeremy Jeffers possibly taking over as the
really
closer.
Turned it around. Jeffers really turned it around, big time.
Yeah, you pair him with guys like Will Smith. I thought Broxton was okay. The difference for me between Broxton and K-Rod is negligible. I think they're basically the same guy at this stage of their respective careers. So why double down? Why go out and commit a multi-year deal to K-Rod? I don't know if that was a Doug Melvin decision or a Mark Attanasio decision, or if both owner and GM were on the same page in this case, but it seems like every time Milwaukee makes a signing in February or March, I come away pretty unhappy about it.
Yeah, you do. Same thing happened with you with Kyle Loesch, but let's see. I mean, this is a tough one for me. I can't say that I agree with that decision. I'm more in your camp. I think I would have gone with the younger guys, but K-Rod has done it before, and they like that. So good luck. That's all I can say, because that is not a good park for him to pitch in at all.
No, it is not. I think he's a outside the top 20 type closer, kind of falls into the Joe Nathan range for me, a guy that you could see getting knocked around and possibly still losing the job even with that contract, although a guaranteed two-year deal should offer him plenty of leash. Last week, we found out Michael Saunders had suffered a knee injury. It was a result of a sprinkler head that he had tripped over during spring training. The good news here is that the injury is not as bad as previously feared. He had a large section of his meniscus removed, which actually speeds up the timetable as compared to a meniscus repair. Saunders is expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks, possibly returning in mid-April instead of returning sometime around the All-Star break. The Jays did go out and sign Dion Vicieto to a minor league deal over the weekend, but looking at the Jays' outfield depth now and seeing this shorter timetable, I feel as though they may actually just stand pat with what they have and let Saunders come back and take on that everyday role, or at least that the larger side of a platoon, as they had planned all along.
You know, I heard some comments by manager Gibbons about Vicieto, and I must say that there was absolutely no enthusiasm or excitement about Vicieto being on his club. I was just stunned at the lack of emotion in the response. You know, usually you want to hear, well, we're really glad to have this big bat, you know, 20 home run guy can take over in left field. But he was like ambivalent to the entire situation. And it kind of said to me, I guess you weren't on board with this decision, because, you know, they needed someone and they're not deep in the outfield. So Diane Vicieto is their guy.
He's at least got a shot to make the team as a DH left field option. I know Danny Valencia might see a little bit of time in the outfield this spring. Kevin Pillar trying to make the club as a backup. Pillar can play all three outfield spots. So I think there's a good chance that he's going to stick. But they have other options. They have Chris Dickerson in camp. They have Andy Dierks, if Dierks can get healthy. Caleb Gindel, former Milwaukee prospect, trying to hang around. And they've got a few DH options, too, that, you know, if they decide to keep extra first baseman, they may have to teach someone else how to play left, as they are possibly doing with Valencia. I mean, they still have Deonner Navarro. I could actually see the Blue Jays hooking up with a team like San Diego or like Arizona for a trade, and maybe flipping a guy like Navarro elsewhere to get a more established veteran, or even a younger outfielder that you have a little more confidence in than Vicieto.
I talked to a Diamondbacks scout yesterday about Navarro, and I said, am I missing something, or is this a natural? Wouldn't it be a good idea for Navarro to come to the Diamondbacks and maybe one of their extra outfielders go the other way? And he was totally on board. He said that's the first thing he thought of. So obviously this isn't just you and I thinking of it. It seems like a natural to me. The Diamondbacks, however, and we're going to talk about it later in catchers, the Diamondbacks are going to be committed to Peter O'Brien as sure as I'm sitting here. He will be on that club. I just don't know when. He is their catcher. You know, Tuffy Goswich will staff the position until they are convinced that O'Brien cannot sit in the minor leagues anymore. We're going to bring him up. So don't think O'Brien's going to be a minor leaguer all year long, because he will not.
Yeah, I feel like by May or June even we could see him, if not a little bit sooner. Seems like the Diamondbacks are definitely sold on the bat, and they seem to also believe in O'Brien more as a defensive catcher than many evaluators out there do. I want to talk about Rusty Castillo, Bernie. He's dealing with an oblique strain. Odd series of events. Yesterday seemed to hurt his left side during his final at-bat in an exhibition game. From there, he was examined here on Wednesday morning. Seemed as though it wasn't a big deal, according to some early morning reports, and then we found out a few hours later it's actually an oblique strain. He's going to miss at least 1 week. I've also been surprised, though, that this during camp, early on at least, he's been competing for the center field job with Mookie Betts. I thought Betts would actually just push Shane Victorino and take the job at right. Castillo would be the guy in center field. He's got a $72 million contract, but it seems like Castillo actually has to earn his spot on the roster.
Yeah, I think I said on this show last week that they really want Victorino to play. Until he can show he's not healthy, Victorino's going to be the right fielder. So that left Betts and Ruzny to fight it out at center field. I still think Betts is going to be there. Something says to me that this guy's going to play, and play an awful lot. Now, with the body type that Castillo has, which is not, he is not svelte. You know, he's got some bulk to him. I think this could be a lingering injury. I think this reminds me of Jason Kipnis. You know, when Kipnis hurt his oblique, it hurt him all year long. I don't know how serious this is, but that's the first thing I thought of. With a guy that isn't thin, I think it's going to be an issue for him, and they're going to rest him up. I think it's more than a week.
Definitely could be, and that may open up the center field job for Betts to begin the year, depending on how long this oblique strain lingers for Rusny Castillo. Let's talk about Jose Peraza. He's impressing in Braves camp, and it seems like the Braves manager, Freddy Gonzalez, is sort of adding fuel to the fire and really talking up his young second baseman quite a bit. It seems like there's actually an outside chance that he could make the opening day roster. And regardless of when he arrives, maybe it's April, maybe it's May or June, do you think Peraza is at the point in his career, he's still very young, where he can hit enough against big league pitching to steal a lot of bases and be an immediate fantasy contributor?
I think it's very, very possible. I like this kid. The Braves have nothing to lose except his clock. I think they need some offense on that club. They need a spark. This is a very lifeless offense, in my opinion. And I do think he's going to break camp with them. I think he's going to be a surprise. Of course, it's very early, but I don't know how deep they are at that position. And I think he could just win the job.
Yeah, it seems like the Braves coaches are divided. According to Gonzalez, half the coaches say he's ready to go. The other half say, nah, give him a couple months. He hasn't got any higher than Double A. Only 44 games at Double A for Jose Peraza. Just 20 years old. He's going to turn 21 in late April. I could see the benefit of just giving him a few more weeks even at Double A. Maybe skipping him over Triple A entirely if they do feel he's ready to go. Because their second base depth chart is ugly.
I would not do it. I would not promote him now. I would keep him in the minor leagues for quite a while because they have nothing to gain and everything to lose in service time. They're going nowhere. Let this kid finish his development. But the word I hear is that there are guys that are really pushing for him and they want to be more respectable than not respectable, and they think he can do it. This is a good story for spring training. We'll know more in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, it could be a hot spring that vaults him onto the opening day roster, but it could be a cold one that sends him down to Double A for at least a few weeks to begin the year. Still a lot of ground to cover for Jose Peraza here this spring. Bernie, I want to talk about some players that we're unlikely to own on our teams at their current prices. I wrote up a blog a while back covering some of these guys, and I want to start with D. Gordon. I mean, last year, I know you liked him as a cheap source of speed. I didn't take the chance on him. That was to my detriment. But now the price has gotten really expensive on D. Gordon. Making the move from Los Angeles to Miami, he's projected to lead off for the Marlins. I think they've got a few different options they could use atop the lineup if he struggles to hit. And he did struggle in the second half. I know a lot of people are concerned about Billy Hamilton and how much Hamilton tailed off after the All-Star break. But D. Gordon really did the exact same thing. I don't think I'm going to have D. Gordon anywhere. Right now, if you're talking about a 15-team mix league like the NFBC, you probably have to use a third-round pick to get him. And for me, he's still kind of a two-and-a-half category player. I think the batting average could come down from the .289 he hit last year. And you're really just left with runs scored and steals, where the run scored count could fall if the Marlins do decide to go back to Christian Yelich as their leadoff man or lean on somebody like Martin Prado at the top of the order.
I'm very bullish about Gordon. And let me tell you a quick story. I had lunch with a Marlins scout yesterday. When they traded for D. Gordon was in San Diego at the time. He found out he was going to be a Marlin. At I think it was midnight or something like that, he called them and said, hey, you guys are in San Diego now for the meetings, right? They said, yeah. He said, can I come over and meet you guys? I am really excited. So there he was. Didn't matter what time of day it was. He made his way over to the hotel to meet the brass. And I'll tell you, they were tremendously impressed with D. Gordon. They love his attitude. They love everything about him. And I've sat and talked with him. He is just a terrific young man. I kind of disagree with you on him. I think he's going to be just fine. He may not repeat last year, but he is not going to hurt anybody who owns him. He's on a very good ball club. He's getting good coaching. He's getting better and better all the time. I'm a D. Gordon guy, and I want him anywhere I can have him.
Yeah, see, I think for me, too, there's another aspect of this, even beyond what Gordon can bring you, is just that so much of his value is tied up in one category. I'm finding that in deeper leagues in particular, I don't want to lean too heavily on one guy as a one-category player, because if he were to go down with a groin or a hamstring or just some kind of injury that limits his ability to steal bases, I have a lot of ground to make up in that category. It becomes very difficult to find, you know, two really good sources of stolen bases on the waiver wire to fit into your lineup who can match that level of production. Certainly, if he repeats what he did last year, he's actually worth more than a late third round pick. But I have my doubts about the batting average in particular. And obviously, you're never going to get power from him. That's not why you draft him in the first place. But D. Gordon, for me, just a little bit too expensive as we move into draft season. What about Adam Wainwright, Bernie? I mean, we talked about him last week, the abdominal strain that had the Cardinals send him back to St. Louis for an examination. Doesn't appear to be anything too serious. He threw a bullpen session on Monday. My reservations with Wainwright are still tied up in that strikeout rate. I think that's an issue. I don't know if that's necessarily going to come back. Last year, 7.1 Ks per nine. The control's still good. I think he can still be a workhorse. But I just get the feeling that the Cardinals are going to monitor his workload a little bit closer than usual. And you might see closer to 200 innings rather than the 225 plus that we've been accustomed to from Adam Wainwright.
Yeah, I think it's all going to be price driven. I still think he's, you know, he's worth it. The reports are much better than what we thought they could be. So that's a plus for me, and I'm still on him. But I'm going to tell you a guy that I'm staying away from, and it might surprise you, DVR, but I want no shares of C.J. Wilson. I do not trust it. I do not think that he is going to be a winner, and I just can't pay that price.
Yeah, I don't want Wilson either. I mean, I think at this point he's gone from a potential discount source of strikeouts to a ratio nightmare. 4.51 ERA last year, 1.45 WHIP. That 3.39 that he put up in 2013, that ERA, I don't think he's getting back to that level, barring some really unforeseen shifts. I could just see him being a complete disaster. So no disagreement at all from me on C.J. Wilson. Just one of those guys I'm not taking that late flyer on. Nelson Cruz, also a player I don't want to have on my team this year. Moving from Baltimore to Seattle, that's a big deal. We talked about it when he signed. I mean, right-handed power really gets dried up at Safeco. I think you have to look at the struggles he's had in some of the other parks in the division, too. Oakland's been a difficult place for him to hit. Anaheim's been a difficult place for him to hit. His career numbers at Safeco haven't been very good. He gets a couple of nice road stops with Texas and Houston, where he's had some success. But playing 81 games at Safeco, no thanks. I think you're talking about a high 20s home run guy in the absolute best case scenario, but more likely 22 to 25 home runs seems like his total coming up here in 2015.
I still think I'd take my chances on him, because if he doesn't hit home runs for me, he could get some gap doubles that'll drive in runs on a better club. So I'm looking at the club having being improved. I still want him. Maybe not at a steep price, at a fair market value, I'll take him.
Yep.
The guy I'm going to shy away from is Pedro Alvarez. And I know I'm walking away from a huge monster season of home runs, but I just don't want Adam Dunn anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a concern. I mean, 230, 235 is probably where he checks in batting average. But what's the difference between Pedro Alvarez and Chris Carter this year, really? I mean, I see equal risk in both of them with very similar power potential. I think the one thing that favors Carter, he's a DH, and he's in a park that's better for power hitters, especially a right-handed power hitter. But I look at Carter as a guy that's hard to pay the premium for right now, whereas Alvarez might offer almost the same amount of value 100 picks or 125 picks later.
I'll take Carter, because I think there's 10 more home runs in there than Alvarez. I love the park factor. I like the guys a little bit around him in the lineup, and I think he's another year more mature. I think Carter's going to have a big year. I think his batting average is going to improve a little. I still think he's going to strike out a lot, but this guy has awesome power, and that's what I want. The thing about Alvarez that I don't want is sulking, playing first base, and how is that going to get into his head? So I'll take Carter. I'll give you Alvarez.
Let's take a look here at the other other guy I wanted to bring up. It's Sonny Gray. I think Sonny Gray is a very good young pitcher. I like what he can bring to the table. What I have my issue with him is that I don't think he's going to show us a lot more than he did last year. 183 strikeouts in 219 innings. 3.08 ERA, 1.19 WHIP. It's a very good pitcher, but he's being drafted 25, 30, 35, 40 spots ahead of pitchers I like just as much. I think for me, I just don't want to pay that premium for Sonny Gray, because I don't know if the WHIP's going to get that much better. He had the 1.11 whip over 12 appearances in 2013, but I don't know if he's going to be an asset in that category this season.
I have to agree with you that what you see is what you get. I don't see much upside left. Funny, yesterday I tweeted out from the Oakland game that he and Doolittle are the only two guys that were drafted on the 25-man, which is amazing to me.
Yeah, that's a pretty big overhaul for that roster, but it sounds pretty typical of Billy Beane, I guess, the more you think about it, especially when you look back at just this offseason alone, turning so many pieces over. But even before that, I mean, Derek Norris was a guy they had gotten to trade with the Nationals. Obviously, he's gone now. Brandon Boss was a player that they got off of waivers. I think he was DFA'd, and they picked him up off waivers or signed him as a minor league free agent.
Right?
Yeah, it was either waivers or a minor league free agent. I can't remember for sure, but they got him for next to nothing for another organization. I mean, they flipped a lot of pieces that still weren't even there. So I wonder if you look back historically, when the last time was they had more than five or six players in the 25-man roster that they had brought up on their own.
Yeah, this is really, it's really amazing. You know, I had to read it twice before I wrote it. Two guys. That's really saying something.
All right, so I've got a few draft day toss-ups lined up here, Bernie. We've talked about Chris Carter before, comparing him to Pedro Alvarez. They're not going anywhere near each other in draft, so it's not really a decision you necessarily have to make. It's just an option if you don't draft Carter and you want to try to get low average and some power later. Alvarez is the kind of guy that might be able to do it. But Carter versus David Ortiz, they're pretty much next to each other in ADP. I know Ortiz is becoming something of a batting average risk, but not nearly to the degree that Carter has a very low floor. Which one do you take, Carter or David Ortiz?
I take the aging David Ortiz. This guy is so dangerous with men on base in that ballpark that I drool when I think of possibly having this guy on my team. I think he's going to play at age 86. The bat is as quick and as fast. The hands are as fast as they've ever been. I know he's troubled by this keeping one foot in the box business. I hope it doesn't come back to haunt him. But he's a lethal hitter, DVR, for average, for RBIs, for home runs, for runs. He'll give you everything but stolen bases.
Yeah, I feel like the dip in batting average last year may have just been the result of lesser fortune on balls in play. His bat really tailed off. And I don't think it's a case where defenses were shifting against him a whole lot differently than they had been in previous seasons. So I could see a rebound in that batting average category. Maybe he loses a little bit of playing time volume, particularly against lefties because they've got such a crowded depth chart. But if he loses one start a week, that still doesn't hurt his counting stats all that much. I'd rather have Ortiz than Carter. I know some people out there do think Carter offers more ceiling because he's so much younger, but I'm just not in that camp. Now, I've got another toss-up involving a member of the Red Sox, Dustin Pedroia versus Colton Wong. It's hard to believe that Pedroia's stock has fallen this much. Injuries have certainly been a big part of that. Wong showing the double-digit home run power and 20 steal ability last year for the Cardinals. Seems to be a hitter on the rise. Who do you go with? Do you go with the laser show or do you go with Colton Wong?
I want Pedroia in that new lineup. I think he's going to score a ton of runs. I think he's going to steal a few more bases. I think Wong is on the come, but not there yet. I'll take the proven Pedroia to bounce back, have a great year, show who he is, and be the leader of that club. This is an awesome offense, and he will be a major part of it. And that's the reason I'm going with Pedroia over Wong. It's not, St. Louis does not have anywhere close to the firepower that Boston does.
I would definitely agree with that overall, and I think Pedroia seems to be healthy. The wrist and hand injuries he's been dealing with the last 2 years, I think those have subsided. Maybe you get a dozen home runs from him. I think the run scored category, as you pointed out, batting average, those are going to be among, I think, some of the better players in the pool, even in the American League side, particularly that run scored count. So I like Dustin Pedroia quite a bit at his current price, even though in a keeper league, the answer, I think, would obviously, for me, it'd be Wong for multiple years. But for this year only, it's Dustin Pedroia. Three third basemen in this next toss-up, Bernie. Three of them, the triangle match, as they like to call it, I think, in the WWE. Evan Longoria, Nolan Arenado, and Kyle Seager. How do you rank them, one, two, and three, just between those three players? Because they seem to be available around the same time in many drafts.
This is a great one, DVR. I've gone round and round, not with number one. Arenado is my number one. Clearly, I target him. I got him in the CBS league this year, and I was very happy to have him. So Arenado is my number one. I'm almost going to back off my bad comments about Evan Longoria because I like the park factor better than I like Seattle, but I love Seager. So I'd say it's Longoria 2, Seager 3, which is unlike everything I always say about Longoria, but he's still a darn good ball player. Seager is streaky. He had a very streaky year last year. I think he'll have another streaky year this year. Longoria is very streaky, but I like playing in Tampa better than Seattle. Very close between 2 and 3, but Arenado, he's my man.
Take a look at the splits, home, road, and lefty-righty the last two seasons from Kyle Seager. If he ever puts everything together at once, there's still one more level for him to reach. I just don't know if that's going to happen. The park certainly makes it more difficult. I like Longoria the most of this bunch. Longoria just ahead of Seager. I've got Arenado third. Look at his numbers outside of Coors Field. He could still get better. I think that's the thing that makes Arenado so appealing. I know there's at least one person out there. I forget who it was. I think it might have been Gray Albright from Razzball, but he had Nolan Arenado as a top 20 overall player for this year, which, I mean, I can't get on board with that because you don't have to draft him that early and you can still get him two or three rounds later potentially. The question for you with Arenado, Bernie, when you look at him and his long-term projection as a hitter, what is his ultimate ceiling in terms of power? Can he be a 30 home run guy, mostly because of the park that he's in, or is he more likely to fall in the 20 to 25 range, albeit with a good average throughout his prime years?
Home runs are not his thing. I see 20 to 25. I think he'll bulk up a little bit more and hit some more home runs. That's fine. I want him for the batting average and the RBIs and hitting the gaps. You know, the home runs are going to, they'll be there. Don't get me wrong. 25, I'm comfortable with. I think when you're talking 30, that's probably a bit too much, but he's still number one. Would you repeat your ranks for me, DVR? You broke up in that one section.
Yeah, I've got Longoria first, Seager second, Arenado third. I like all three of these players. I like it. I like the fact that you could get them at a point where you don't necessarily have to pay the premium that Longoria once carried. I mean, I've always liked Longoria, and I know last year he stayed healthy for the second year in a row. The numbers really fell off, but at the current price, I mean, we're talking early fourth round, mid fourth round, I'm taking the chance. I get the feeling that some of the issues he had with plate coverage last year are something he can actually fix. I don't think he's at the point in his career where he's really in decline just yet. Got a couple more here, Bernie. Got one behind the plate, Wilson Ramos versus Yasmani Grandal. Two catchers that have had a lot of injury issues, but both have a lot of upside with the bat. Which one do you prefer?
This is Wilson Ramos's year. I think he's going to – I said it last year. It didn't happen. I like this guy an awful lot. I think he's got a big bat. I also like Grandal. I think he's working on some things. He's not – you know, there's some good catchers this year. I ranked him 20th when we go to that. But I'll take Ramos.
I'm also going to take Ramos. Slight difference between them in my rankings, but not a huge gap. But two catchers I'd be pretty happy with this year if I'm waiting – at that position and don't want to pay a premium for, you know, a Posey, a Gattis, a Mesoraco, a Lucroy, whatever it may be. If I miss out on those guys, I feel pretty good about both Ramos and Grandal this year. I got one shortstop toss-up this week. Elvis Andrus versus Jean Segura. Which one do you like better? Both offer a lot of speed, but who do you feel better about for this season?
I think I want Segura because I think he's going to have a huge comeback year. The worst is behind him. I think we're going to see the Segura of 2 years ago. I think they're on a mission as a club, and they need him desperately. He's my guy over Andrus. I think Andrus is in decline, frankly.
Yeah, Andrus, I don't think I've owned him many places over the last 3-4 years. This is probably not going to be the year where I start to buy in. He is dealing with a case of patella tendonitis in his knee right now, too, so he's going to miss a few games in camp. But independent of that, at this stage, I'm looking at Segura as someone I might feel better about. The only issue is that I think there's a better chance that Andrus hits higher up in the order for the Rangers. I think Segura has a little more in terms of obstacles keeping him in the bottom third of the Milwaukee lineup. So I think that's the one area right now that would lead me to think about Andrus over Segura, but it's very close. And it's almost like,
Okay.
to me, Segura is the reason why I don't want to pay a premium for Andrus, even though that premium may only be two or three rounds difference. All right, let's talk catcher rankings here, Bernie. We've shared other positions so far as we've gone through the last few weeks. Catcher is the position of the week. We're going to take a look at our top 20 options working from the bottom of the list up until the top. And I think there's some value this year if you do get stuck waiting at the position, as I alluded to earlier. We're talking about Wilson Ramos and Yasmani Grandal. Starting at number 20, I'm going to roll the dice on Josh Fegley. I think that's going to be an underrated move. As part of that White Sox A's offseason trade, the one that sent Jeff Samardzija to the south side of Chicago, Josh Fegley was one of the pieces that went back the other way. I know he has not hit in his chances to play at the big league level over the last two seasons. He got a lot more time in 2013 than he did in 2014. But his numbers at AAA, the power in particular, has been very impressive. He wasn't playing in the PCL. I like Fegley as that wait on a catcher, cheap source of power guy.
Yeah, he's going to have to make a lot of improvement to get on my top 20 based on what I've seen of him. My 20 is Yasmani Grandal, simply because he's not a known commodity to me yet. I've always liked him, but this is his time to prove it. If he proves it, he improves, but at least now he's in my top 20.
I got Grandal a bit higher. We'll bring him up momentarily. John Jaso is my number 19 catcher. And the appeal here is that he could hit second for the Rays. He'll probably platoon, but he'll be on the larger side of the platoon. The DH role will take away a lot of the risk that's associated with catching. He's had his share of concussions, but his numbers against righties have been really good. I think the playing time volume ultimately goes up. I think you're looking at a good average with decent on-base skills, maybe 10 to 12 home runs, and a really good number of runs scored.
John Jaso is my number 19, but bear in mind, folks, this will be the last year you'll get him at catcher. He is not going to catch. He may not catch five games. They don't want him to catch. That's not his role anymore. And because he can hit, he's going to be a good value for you, and that's why he's 19 for me.
Moving up to number 18, I've got Jared Saltalamacchia. The strikeout rate, that's not going to go away. That's not going to come down. But he gets to back up a lot of the quality bats in that Marlins order. So I think there's going to be a surprisingly high number of RBI chances there. I think the double-digit home run power he showed throughout his career is pretty legitimate. So for me, even though you're taking a batting average hit, Salty goes into the number 18 spot.
No salt in my wounds this year at all. He doesn't even make my top 25. My number 18 is Stephen Vogt, who I think is an underrated hitter. He's going to catch most of the time, and I think he's going to put up some big numbers and surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, keep in mind with Vogt, there are some leagues out there where he will not be a catcher at the beginning of the season. I think he only caught 15 games last year rather than 20, so be sure to check your league rules. He should be catching as the season begins. However, he'll pick up catcher eligibility soon after the season begins, but just something to be on the lookout for as you're doing your draft prep. My number 17 catcher is a former Oakland A. It's Derek Norris, even though he's hitting in San Diego now. I think he's a pretty good source of OBP. Batting average should be decent. Home run power, I mean, he showed some of it last year in Oakland's tougher environment going to Petco, but I think he's pretty stable, and that volume of playing time should be there pretty much all season long for Norris.
I have him ranked better than that. My 17 is Jason Castro of the Astros. I've seen the good, I've seen the bad, I've seen the ugly. The job is his. I don't think they're trading him, and that's where he lands for me.
Castro just on the outside looking in at my top 20, but if you're talking about a 15-team league where you start two catchers, definitely someone that would be on your draft list. Yasmani Grandal, we talked about earlier, he makes my list at number 16. It seems like he's in line to get about two-thirds of the starts behind the plate for the Dodgers. It leaves A.J. Ellis as the backup. Maybe Ellis is going to be a trade target for some of the other teams in need of help behind the plate. But for me, it's just a matter of health with Grandal. He's had all sorts of injuries that have slowed him down at this point in his career.
My 16 is Miguel Montero, simply because he's a full-time catcher with the Cubs. He's got a fresh start. I hope he's better than he was in his last 2 years with the Diamondbacks. He had to make my list. However, if Peter O'Brien breaks camp as the Diamondbacks catcher, he slips right into 16 and Miguel Montero goes to 21.
Looking at my number 15, it's Mike Zunino. I'm worried about the batting average, but I think there is still some potential room for growth there. He's going to try to change his approach a little bit, keep the bat in the strike zone a little longer, use the opposite field more effectively. If he can show some improvement there, I think the batting average can tick up into the 220, 230 range. Plenty of raw power. I mean, we're talking more like 20 home run power than the 10 to 12 or even 15 that a lot of the catchers I have ranked below him are going to provide. So that's a big part of the appeal for me, is that Zunino tends to have above average power for a catcher.
I'm a huge Mike Zunino fan. I want his home runs. I have him ranked much higher than that. At 15, I have Russell Martin with Toronto, simply because I still think he can hit some, but I don't think he's going to hit as well as Toronto thinks he will.
Yeah, I think they have this idea he's going to be their number two hitter, and if that holds up all year, he might carry added value in the form of runs scored, just because he's going to have Bautista and Encarnacion, plenty of big bats behind him to drive him in. But I also look at this as a possibility of a significant drop-off, even though he's changing leagues to a more friendly hitter environment in Toronto, and going into the AL has a chance to collect more plate appearances. I do worry that last year was Babbitt-fueled and that you're going to see a drop-off in the batting average category, and Russell Martin's going to be a little bit less appealing. I've got him at 13 for what it's worth, so we're not too far apart on him. I've got Miguel Montero at 14. I think he's going to see more regular rest with the Cubs, but compared to the lineup he had around him in Arizona last year, I think he's going to have even more RBI chances. Like, the batting average is pretty stable. I think Montero's pretty safe. I think he's just one of those guys that he's not going to win your league for you, but he's certainly not going to lose it for you either.
At 14, I have Travis d'Arnaud with the Mets. If he doesn't do it this year, I don't know when he's going to do it. This guy had so much hype around him, the second coming. I don't know. He's not Mike Piazza, and we're not even close, but I've got to put him in here and hope he does it.
Look at d'Arnaud's numbers, though, from June on last year. He had a concussion early in the year, and once he got healthy, it seemed like things really came back together. From June 24th on, he had 272, he had 19 doubles, 10 home runs, 32 runs driven in, really over a span of about 3 months, cut the strikeout rate down. I think this is a breakout kind of materializing here with Travis d'Arnaud. Wouldn't be surprised at all if he ended up finishing the year as a top 10 catcher. I've got him at 12, so I think we both like him pretty similarly here. Russell Martin was my 13th ranked catcher. For the reasons I mentioned, I think he's sort of stable like Miguel Montero is, gets to hit higher in the order, gets a more hitter-friendly environment. So that's why I've got Martin over Montero, but I've got d'Arnaud over both of them.
And I've got Derek Norris at 13, simply because I think he's a hit-first guy, and I think he will hit. I think the Padres have some protection for him. I think it's a nice lineup, a good park for him. Not a home run hitter. Huge gaps there. I don't think Derek Norris will disappoint.
Like I said, I've got d'Arnaud in the 12 spot, so only two spots higher than you do. I think we're pretty similar in what he brings to the table. Who did you have at 12?
This is where I slotted Matt Wieters, who is my huge question mark. I don't know who this guy is, DVR, because he's so big and he should be hitting so well. Of course, he was hurt. He is going to come back. But what's he going to be when he comes back? There's no way I could put him higher, and there's no way I could put him lower. This should be his slot. He is the 12th best catcher on my list, and this is a big year for him because I also think it's his walk year.
Yeah, I think Wieters is a tough rank right now. In my overall rankings, I have Wieters, Wilson Ramos, and d'Arnaud all back-to-back. They're pretty much even to me. It's just a matter of preference. I feel a little better about Wieters, even though he's coming off a major injury. He's been pretty durable throughout his career. So I have Wilson Ramos in the 11th spot with Wieters, one spot ahead of him at 10. Ramos is really appealing to me because he has flashed elite skills just without the heavy workload of a typical number one starter. I think it was a broken hamate bone last year that slowed him down for a stretch. If he's fully healthy, I really like what he could bring to the table in that Washington lineup.
I've got him at 11 as well. I love the guy. And remember what he went through being kidnapped? I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, that's pretty scary. And that's way beyond him now. This is the time for Wilson Ramos to shine.
Yeah, he's had a kidnapping, an ACL tear. He's had the hamate bone. He's had all sorts of different things that have happened to him on and off the field over the last few years. Hopefully everything comes together for him here in 2015. As I mentioned, Matt Weider is my 10th ranked catcher. Bernie, who do you have ahead of Wilson Ramos?
There we go with Evan Gattis, simply because I don't think he's a good defensive catcher at all. I don't think he's a good left fielder at all. But man, when he gets into the ball, it rockets. I love the home runs, and I think he'll hit some.
Keep Gattis in on the back burner. We'll talk about him again a little bit later because I don't have him in this part of my rankings. I've got him quite a bit higher. There's a couple of reasons for it, and I'll explain those momentarily. Looking at the number 9 spot, I've got Willen Rosario at 9. I know they signed Nick Hundley and Mike McHenry still there, and there are some defensive issues. I just can't give up on him. I think he's a legitimately good hitter. I think if there's a team that acquires him that wants to play him even more at first base than the Rockies are planning on doing, I think he can hit in places outside of Colorado. Rosario also had an injury last year. It kind of hid the fact that he showed some improvement in terms of his plate discipline. I've still got Rosario pretty high. I've got him at number 9.
I've got him higher than that because I love the guy's bat. At 9, that's where I've got Zunino. All at right. 8, I've got Yadier Molina.
Yeah, so you got Molina at 8, and I've got Molina up a little higher than this. But I want to talk about Zunino again for a second. When you look at Mike Zunino as a hitter, what's the ceiling for batting average? What's the best case scenario first for this year and long term when you evaluate him as a hitter?
Do you remember me telling you when I saw Zunino in the fall league, probably what, 4 years ago? He said to me, he looked me in the eye and he said, I'm going to break camp as the starting catcher with this club. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my goodness, this guy thinks a lot about his ability. But you know what? You need that behind the plate. Mike Zunino is a gamer. He wants to beat you. I think he's a 260 hitter. I think it can happen consistently, especially with a better lineup around him. What I like about him is that he can hit a home run out of Seattle. That's how much strength this guy has, and he's getting better and better. Zunino is one of the guys that I went after. I think I got him in the CBS league. I'm not sure. I may not have. But he's a guy I really like.
Sal Perez was my number 8 ranked catcher. I worry that Ned Yost is going to just run him into the ground. I mean, that's been the case the last 2 seasons. You can see it in the second half and into the postseason last year. But the thing about Perez that makes him really appealing to me is I think he's actually good at controlling the strike zone. I know there were some times last year where he was up there flailing. He doesn't walk a lot, but he typically doesn't strike out that much either for a guy that can certainly put a charge into the ball. 17 home runs last year, 70 runs driven in, because he hits high up in the order. I think he exceeds last season's 260 average and checks in closer to that 292 or maybe even that 301 that we saw from him back in 2012.
I have always been a huge fan, but I got a little upset last year when he was pulling everything. Every time he went to the plate, even that was a game-tying hit in the World Series where he pulled the ball down the left field line. This is a guy that has got to use more of the field, and you cannot just pitch him inside. Let him use the rest of the field because he's got tremendous ability. And I've got him at 6 because I do think he's that good. He is a big kid. You don't realize it until I saw him standing next to Sandoval, and he just towers over Sandoval. He is that big, and he's that strong. This could be a big year for him if he uses the whole field.
He's a giant behind the plate, and I think he would actually benefit from the less is more concept with regards to his playing time volume. If you got a day off once a week consistently, I think that might actually keep him fresh over the course of a full season. Moving up to number 7, Bernie, Brian McCann. I know he let us down last year. I don't think he's going to be able to beat the shift and hit for much average, but I still think if you're talking catchers who are safe bets to hit 20 home runs, there aren't many of them. And in that park, in that lineup where he can drive in some runs, I still feel pretty good about what he can do in those run-producing categories.
I'm with you, friend. I've got him at 7, but you know, we're both nuts because we said it last year. We were drooling about him going into Yankee Stadium, and he laid an egg. Now, mark my words, this is his last shot with me. If he does not come through and I waste money or draft choices on him, you know, I'll never pick him up again. But the potential is so great in that ballpark with that swing, unless it has slowed down as much as it did last year. He was coming off injury. We know that. He should be very healthy. It should play this year. I've got him right there with you at seven.
I think the one thing I expect to see improve is the plate discipline. He didn't walk as much as he did in previous years in 2014. That's the one area where I see a little bit of a correction. Maybe he drives a few more pitches as a result, and the home run total ticks up just a little bit more. I think 25 is still within the range for Brian McCann, even though, as I said, batting average is going to be a problem. He's not the type of hitter who I expect to be able to start beating the shift, especially now that he's past age 30. Jan Gomes is my number six ranked catcher. I like what Gomes can bring to the table. I think what he does that concerns me a little is just that he has some platoon splits that point to him being more of a lefty killer who's okay, not great against righties. 15 home runs last year against righties bodes well, but only a 745 OPS against righties, 879 against lefties. I don't know how much more he can do against right-handed pitching than he did last year. That's the only reason why Gomes isn't higher on my list.
Yeah, I have him higher, but shame on me. I traded him last year in our keeper league because I thought it was a mirage. It's not a mirage. He's a good hitter. And I have him at three. And at six, I had Perez. At five, I have Willian Rosario. Huge comeback for Rosario. He's a much better hitter than he showed us last year. He's going to play more at first base. It's going to be worthwhile. Morneau's going to DH some. In American League parks and against American League clubs, you're going to see Rosario really bounce back.
The next guy I have on my list at number five is definitely a bounce back candidate of sorts. Yadier Molina suffered that thumb injury last year, was limited to just 110 games, typically a workhorse. 3 years in a row prior to last season, hit at least 305 with double-digit home run power. I think he gets back to those levels. Plenty of runs driven in because he'll hit high enough in that Cardinals lineup. I'm not looking for the dozen steals that he gave us back in 2012, but I feel like this is a nice buy-low opportunity, at least a relative buy-low opportunity on Yadier Molina.
At four, I've got Devin Mesoraco of the Reds, who I've always liked. The park is perfect for him. He came into his own last year. He's a terrific hitter, and I think he should go nuts.
Here's my question for you. First on Rosario, I mean, you've got him at five. I've got him at nine. I don't think most people are still that high on him because they have some concerns about his playing time. If you were a GM of a different team, would you acquire him and make him an everyday first baseman? Do you think his bat is good enough where you could play him every day as a first baseman?
Actually, I'd put him in the American League as a designated hitter, and I'd leave him there. I don't think defensively he is strong either behind the plate or at first base. It's not that he doesn't work hard. As a catcher, he works extremely hard. It's just that his footwork is not there, and the coordination is not there. His eye-hand coordination is superb, Derek, but his coordination of the lower body and the footwork is just not there yet. He has trouble blocking balls. He has trouble shifting. And that's where the problems occur. Then he falls behind, rushes his throw, and gets an error. So he's a liability behind the plate. And the same issues creep in at first base with the lack of agility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that could definitely be something that puts him in the DH role long term. But he's young enough where I feel like there is still that possibility, at least at first base, maybe he could become adequate there to the point where you wouldn't have to necessarily DH him every day. Maybe you could rotate him with an older first baseman, you know, between the DH spot. I mean, think of a team like Anaheim. They have CJ Krohn, who could basically do a lot of the same things as Rosario. But a team like that could possibly utilize a player of Rosario's nature. You mentioned Mesoraco. I have him at four as well. Love what he did last year. I think the breakout is actually pretty sustainable. I'm not looking for that much of a correction based on last season. I mean, is there another level, or is this the peak? Is this as good as it's going to get for Devin Mesoraco?
I think this is as good as going to get, but the park, everything is perfect for him. This is a very, very solid pick at four. He probably could have gone at three for me. Let me go back to Rosario just a second, and I want to talk about Pacheco, because Pacheco, Jordan Pacheco, is very much like Rosario. These are guys that can hit without positions. Pacheco could probably make most clubs if he were a DH, but he's too young. The guy is another gap hitter, not a lot of home runs, right center, left center, with regularity, but he can't find a place to play because he's defensively deficient. So that happens to guys. That's why there, some of them are 4A guys, which Pacheco could be, or the 26th or 27th man on a roster. But it's important to know that if you can hit, they'll find a place for you. And they may find a place for Pacheco and certainly Rosario.
Yeah, Pacheco trying to make the roster in Arizona as of right now. But as Devin Mesoraco goes, Bernie, Brian Price saying he views Mesoraco as a Yadier Molina-type guy who's going to catch 145 games a year. Now, realize last year, Mesoraco hit 25 home runs while playing 114 games. If he gets 145 games, I think that stabilizes the 25 home runs that he hit last year. But if he's able to sustain that rate of power, maybe we can see a 28 or 30 home run season from him.
It's possible, but pitchers are going to bear down on him much more. He's a marked man now because everybody knows what we saw 3 years ago.
Yeah, definitely not sneaking up on anybody anymore. You said you had Yan Gomes at 3. I've got Jonathan Lucroy at 3. If he didn't have the hamstring injury that he suffered a couple weeks ago, he'd be my second-ranked catcher. I had to bump him down one spot just because I think the playing time volume dips a little bit. You mentioned Yan Gomes is your 3 catcher now. At 2, I have Evan Gattis. And the reason why I have Gattis at 2 is because even though he's not a good left fielder or not likely to be a good left fielder, Carlos Lee could play left field in Houston in the later stages of his career because of the Crawford boxes, less ground to cover. You have center fielders who can cover a lot of ground. That's going to help bail him out. I think the Astros are looking at Gattis and seeing a player that could get 140, 145 games in left this year. And if he does that, I think he might be the only catcher on this list who's going to hit 30 home runs this year. And much like a few other players we talked about, enjoy it while it lasts because he will not be a catcher-eligible player in fantasy leagues in 2016.
Well, I have him at 10 because of the fact that I'm not sure how long they're going to stick with him if he gives games away. The home runs will be there. The batting average may not be. But from a pure power standpoint, which we need in fantasy, it's not a bad call, Derek. I have Lucroy at 2. He'd be 1 if he were healthy. But Lucroy is one heck of a catcher. And, you know, this hamstring thing with him has been lingering for 2 years.
Yeah, it does make you wonder if it's just the kind of thing that, because it was early in spring, they could take an extra precautious sort of approach with the treatment, get him the platelet-rich plasma injections, and just make sure that he enters the season as close to 100% as possible. I mean, a player like Lucroy probably doesn't need more than a couple weeks' worth of at-bats late in spring training to get up to speed, so maybe they're just being extra cautious given his importance to their team and in the middle of that lineup, but I had to give him a slight downgrade just because I'm not expecting him to be quite the workhorse that he would have been if he were completely healthy. Buster Posey's my number one ranked catcher. There's a big gap for me between Posey and the rest of my catchers. A lot of it is that he plays first base on the days where he doesn't catch. I think that's still going to hold up against some tough lefties, even though Brandon Belt is becoming an increasingly important part of that offense in San Francisco. I have a long-term question for you with Buster Posey. Is he going to be a catcher for more than another year or two, or do you see him actually moving off that position, maybe becoming a third baseman or a left fielder? Like, where else in the diamond could you see Posey becoming an everyday player?
It all depends upon how he wears and how the job wears on him. You know, we saw what it did to Joe Mauer, and we saw what happened to Joe Mauer when he moved. I think he's got at least 2 more years behind the plate. However, you're going to see more Susek behind the plate this year. They're going to give him more days off. He can stay there if he doesn't have to catch 6 days a week. 5 days a week would be fine. Find him a place to play. Put Belt on the bench against tough lefties and let Posey play first base. But I do think there's at least 2 more years, maybe more, of him behind the plate.
I mean, Posey, if I'm not mistaken, played some shortstop earlier in his college career, but everybody plays shortstop in high school or college at some level. So I don't know if that's indicative of his ability to become a third baseman. I just think about their long-term needs at that position and how his bat actually plays there. I'd be really excited if that happened, but I think it's still more of a long shot. And you're right, if they just monitor his workload, he could probably stay behind the plate quite a bit longer. But 6'1", 220, I think he's got enough athleticism to play other positions. It's just a matter of time.
You know, the thing that bothers me about Mauer is the fact that the expectations on him were so fantastic. He took up a lot of their salary. Everybody talks about how much money he makes, and they paid him as a very highly priced catcher that doesn't hit a whole lot of home runs. Well, now when you're a first baseman, the expectation is that you hit the ball out of the park. Mauer can't do that. So as a first baseman, he is wildly overpaid, and it really isn't fair to the Twins or their fans, but that is the fact of life. We have lost Joe Mauer, in essence, as a fantasy player.
Yeah, he's kind of a late-round corner infield filler right now. Coming off the year, he had just 4 home runs last season in 120 games. I was on the side that thought that playing first base every day, the playing time volume would go up, the injury risk would go down. I thought maybe some of the power would come back. Like maybe he'd hit 15 home runs with a very good batting average, drive in a lot of runs because of the position he has in the heart of that Minnesota order. I sort of like him as a late-round flyer right now, though, Bernie, because Mauer's a good hitter. He's a very good hitter.
And no doubt. He's a doubles machine.
And even though Minnesota's a tough place to hit, like that lineup is still getting better. It will continue to get better. They've got some young players coming through the system. His three-year average is .308 with a .395 on base. How many guys have that ability? Like, that's actually a pretty short list.
Lot of missed playing time, though. Lot of missed playing time. A and B, you know, like I said, when you look at first baseman, and you look, Justin Morneau is a very good example of that. Justin Morneau hits home runs. He hit home runs in Colorado. That's what I paid for when I just won him at auction, because he is in Colorado and the ball is going to go out of the park. You put Joe Mauer in Colorado, he's not hitting home runs there either. It's just not his stroke.
Let's just say the Rockies were to call the Twins and offer up Carlos Gonzalez for Joe Mauer. I mean, would the Rockies ever make an offer like that?
No.
Because Cargo, if he bounces back, I think has a much higher ceiling. But I'm just trying to think of a scenario where the Rockies could actually get him, clear the payroll necessary to do it. Like, but there really isn't a match that I can think of. But if you look back at Morneau's numbers, and he had plenty of injury issues too. I know concussions were a problem, but there were some other serious injuries in his recent history before he got to Colorado. I mean, look at his numbers. He had a .618 OPS in 2011, a .773 OPS in 2012, a .734 OPS in 2013 before he gets to Colorado last year at age 33, no less, and puts up the .860 OPS that we saw a year ago. I see a similar path for Mauer. And I think Mauer, even at his worst, has a higher floor in that batting average category than Morneau. I think the difference is we saw 330 home run seasons from Morneau earlier in his career, whereas with Mauer, we saw 128 home run season, a few low, like 10 to 13 range seasons, and then a lot of single-digit home run seasons.
My purpose in this discussion is to, and you're exactly right, Derek, is to let us understand who Joe Mauer is. Joe Mauer is a terrific hitter, and he is a great RBI guy and doubles machine and batting average guy. He's not going to score a ton of runs in Minnesota, and he's not going to hit home runs. So the value for me is limited to corner infield, not even first base. Corner infield, DH. Corner infield, utility. But a very, very good corner infield utility.
And I think he's underpriced right now, too, which just, it doesn't mean I think he's going to hit 20 home runs. It just means I think you can get more in terms of dollar value earned then you're going to have to spend to get him, or the equivalent of a late-round draft pick. I think he's going to actually give you some profit over the course of the 2015 season. All right, Bernie, we're going to
go over a couple guys that didn't make the top 20, if that's okay with you.
Sure. I mean, yeah, go for it.
First, I mentioned is Peter O'Brien. Guarantee you, as sure as I'm here, Peter O'Brien is the D-backs catcher. I've said it twice today. If he is, he's going to hit a bunch of home runs. He may hit 20 home runs over the course of the season. And if that happens, that would be phenomenal. I can't guarantee it, but I've seen what the guy can do. The other guy I like is Donner Navarro. Donner Navarro should get traded. He's getting a raw deal, you know, over there in Toronto. If he gets traded, he's in my top 20. He can hit.
I like O'Brien. I also like Jasmiel Pinto if the Twins give him the playing time. I think he can hit. It's just a matter of finding at-bats that seems to be the problem for Pinto at this point. Before we close things out, I want to let our listeners know if you have questions for us, send them to us on Twitter, at ShortHops, at Derek Van Riper, at Bernie Pleskoff. Use the hashtag mailbag. We'll try to get to some questions again next week. Before we sign off, Bernie, what's coming up at Pipeline this week?
The last of the On the Cusps. This week, we're talking about the Diamondbacks players. I needed two columns to get all their prospects in. The Rays are on the cusp this week. And there's one more team, and I can't remember who it is. But there will be more On the Cusps this week. And, of course, spring training coverage on my Twitter account, at Bernie Pleskoff. I won't be there every day. I'll be there maybe 5 days out of seven, depending on how I'm feeling. But so far, so good. You can hear I'm losing my voice still. But, Derek, you're going to be here in Phoenix, right?
Yeah, I take off Friday morning for labor, so I'll be around this weekend. I'm sure I'll catch up with you at least at a game, if not for a meal or two over the course of those few days. Unfortunately, a much shorter trip to Arizona for me this year. I tried to make it work longer, just couldn't squeeze it out for the extra days this year. But definitely check out Bernie's pieces over at MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com. We'll talk a lot about spring training as we move through the rest of March. If you're interested in sponsoring this podcast, you can contact Shannon at rotowire.com. The views and opinions of Short Hops are those of Derek and Bernie and no other entity. If you'd like to get a free 10-day trial to RotoWire, you can do that at rotowire.com/pod. Bernie, it's been a pleasure as always. Look forward to doing it again next week.
Looking forward to seeing you here in spring training. I'll bring you my money for the entry fees for our leagues. We'll break bread together. We'll watch games together. We'll break down players together. And have safe travels, DVR.
All right, we'll see you in Arizona. Thanks again for listening to Short Hops. We'll be back with you next week.